While the job market has been bleak for months, military veterans are having an especially hard time. In New York State, the unemployment rate for combat-age vets tops 15%. NPR's Jim Zaroli attended a job fair for vets in New York City that drew more than 2,500 people.
It was perhaps fitting that the job fair was held aboard the Intrepid, the decommissioned aircraft carrier that's now a museum. Many of those who showed up had been out of the service for years. 44-year-old Kenneth Gary fought in the first Gulf War.
I was on tanks. I was an M1 tanker. So you pretty much can't do nothing with tanks out here.
After leaving the Army, he got an associate's degree and went to work at Costco until he was laid off early this year. Now he's on food stamps for the first time and looking for anything he can find.
From January until October, I was living on my 401k. Now it's run out. Now I need a permanent job right now.
So what's the job market like right now?
It's tough. It's really, really, really tough. Like, as you can see, it's a lot of people out here looking for jobs.
In fact, a long line of job hunters snaked down the Hudson River as far as the eye could see. Once inside, they could talk to several dozen recruiters, a lot from public sector employers like Amtrak, but also some from FedEx and Sears. Wayne Packer was there from Lowe's.
We're actually building about 5 stores here in the Metro New York City market, and we're looking for leaders within our stores and probably about 700 total hourly employees to work in this location.
Among those who approached his table was Gil Eichen, a Vietnam vet who's just been laid off after many years at the same company. He showed Packer his resume.
I was a loyal employee to this company.
Okay.
Take a look how long I've been there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my heavens.
People
look at that. My goodness, 40 years. That's fantastic.
Before he was laid off, Eichen worked at a company that prints newspapers, not exactly a growth industry these days. The job hunt is just as tough for less experienced vets. 29-year-old Roberto Alor has spent almost 2 years looking for work after leaving the Army. Now he sleeps on his parents' sofa. He says he'll work anywhere, even McDonald's.
I'm trying to look for a job, but every time I'm looking for a job, they need people with experience plus people with education, which I couldn't because every time I was in the Army, I had to drop my classes because country's first.
It's a common complaint. New York Commissioner of Labor Patricia Smith says many returning vets have been called back to active duty in Iraq and Afghanistan several times, and so they've had trouble completing their education.
What we're seeing is that veterans' lives are disrupted, I think, in ways that we hadn't seen in the past. I mean, it's a tough unemployment climate for anyone. But for someone like that, I think it becomes even more difficult.
And without a degree, says Joseph McDonough, you're basically nowhere. McDonough got out of the Marines a few months ago and still has the haircut to prove it. He used to run a warehouse at Camp Lejeune. But like a lot of vets here, he believes most employers don't really value military service.
The only people who actually see it as being anything glorious are people who are like senior citizens who know that somebody sacrificed something. Now it's, oh, they went away, they didn't go to college. I went to college, I know more than them. They kind of like sneer at you.
But like any good Marine, McDonough is nothing if not self-reliant. He's looking for a temporary job to pay the bills, but then he plans to go to college to study accounting. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Next Tuesday, President Obama is expected to lay out his plans for Afghanistan in a primetime address. NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore sees echoes of the past in the choices the president faces.
As Korea became Truman's war and Vietnam became Johnson's war, so Afghanistan becomes Obama's war. There have been 9 solemn sessions of military and civilian advisors, bridging differences about the way ahead, at least for now. And the president will address the nation in his primetime speech as the reluctant but committed leader. The papered-over differences between military and civilian, between open-ended and tied to performance, between counterterrorism and counterinsurgency, are apparent in the various leaks and briefings that have dotted the path towards a new strategy. It will take months to get the planned reinforcements in place, and more months to train Afghan troops and police, and still more months to deal with the wave of corruption. And all this time, the Taliban and al-Qaeda will not be sitting still. One defense official was quoted as saying, "We have to start showing progress in 6 months on the political side or the military side, or that's it." There are ways out if our troops find the mission impossible. Off-ramps, they're called in one document. But it is inconceivable that American forces would just go away if the going gets too tough. Surely we would hear a call for a military surge to support our troops. War leader Obama is likely to find, as President Johnson did in Vietnam, that the pressure for escalation is great. The understanding among Obama advisers about the conditional employment of troops may not stand up under heavy enemy pressure. Reluctantly donning the toga of war leader, President Obama may be nearing the defining moment of his presidency so far. This is Daniel Shore.
So what if you're looking to have a vegan Thanksgiving? What takes the place of the turkey? Before you run out and buy a tofurkey, we decided to ask Chef Bryant Terry what's going to be on his Thanksgiving table. Bryant calls himself an eco-chef and food justice activist. He's author of the books Grub, Ideas for an Urban Organic Kitchen, and Vegan Soul Kitchen, Fresh, Healthy, and Creative African-American Cuisine. Bryant Terry joins us from Berkeley, California. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, vegan Thanksgiving, you're kind of taking the main dish off the table there, so let's start there. What replaces the bird?
Well, I think, you know, we're in a culture where so often people think there has to be some meat product at the center of the table, and I'm not saying that people should get rid of the bird. If, you know, it's a tradition that people have in their families, I invite that. But I do think it's important that there be a number of delicious, sumptuous options for those that choose not to eat the Thanksgiving turkey. And so often I've been to celebrations where I'm only left with, some bland mashed potatoes and some iceberg lettuce. So I have been in the habit of bringing a lot of delicious sides to make sure that I and the other people who choose not to eat the bird are well fed.
Okay, well, I have one such side sitting in front of me here. Want to tell us about, first of all, what is this seitan?
Seitan is wheat gluten that is often used kind of as a meat substitute. And generally, I don't use a lot of the kind of like meat substitutes like tofu, tempeh, and seitan. I just would rather stick with a big pot of beans or other forms of getting protein. But for this one, you know, one of the dishes I loved growing up when I was an omnivore was smothered pork chops. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to try to replicate that as much as I could. So I tested it out just to give it a try. And it was so sumptuous and delicious that I had to put it in my latest book.
So we have here, it's smothered seitan medallions in a mixed mushroom gravy. How do you make
yes.
that?
Well, you know, I have to say, most of the recipes in my latest book are very simple. If you could boil a pot of water, you can make these. This one, it takes some time because this is slow food, you know, slow cooking. A lot of people talk about slow food and they think about Western Europe, but there are a lot of slow food traditions in African American cuisine. So the stock is homemade. Take fresh mushrooms and we're going to just make a fresh mushroom stock. And then from there, the gravy. And pretty much once the stock and the gravy are made, it's just about letting the seitan simmer in that for about 30 minutes and you got your meal.
All right. Well, if it's Thanksgiving and maybe we do have a turkey in the oven, we've got all day for this dish. Now, you're in California. I'm here in Washington. So in order for me to taste these recipes that you're telling us about, we have called on NPR producer Jack Sahora, who has been cooking up a storm today. Hi there,
yes,
Jack.
Yes, I am. Hi, Jennifer.
Thanks so much for your efforts here. And can we taste this smothered seitan medallion?
Sure. I'm just going to put the seitan actually over rice, which I think Bryant has in his cookbook. And here you go.
Thank you.
Get you the fork here.
Any thoughts on cooking this?
Well, you know, he talks about slow food, and this was for those who are going to make it a little slow. I mean, this probably took me the longest out of anything I made. And it actually opened up my world to cooking in making the stock. Because usually I just take one of those little cubes that you find in the grocery store and throw it into the soup or throw it into my risotto or whatever. And this is the first time I actually made my own mushroom stock. I believe you call it the shroom stock. And mm-hmm. that was the best thing about it. I cannot get enough of that.
Mm. You know, it's really good. Mm.
And this is very, I can see how this is, if you can make this a, sorry, I'm speaking with mouth, food in my mouth. You can make this a main dish. It's going to be quite filling, I can tell. Yeah?
Oh, it is. That's going to be the main dish on my Thanksgiving table this year. And I'll be visiting my fiance's parents. I think they might have a turkey, but for us vegetarians sitting there, we'll be eating the seitan medallions.
Mm, that was really nice. So I see this is a nice, got a nice sauce to it. We've got the rice here. I see a basket of biscuits. Is this where sopping up some of this seitan sauce comes in here?
Sopping is, I don't know, it's a sport in Tennessee where I grew up, or just generally in the South. So if you're going to have a gravy-based dish, you have to have some biscuits on the side so you can sop some things up. So these sweet cornmeal coconut butter drop biscuits, you know, they're great. It's kind of, I use agave
smell
nectar.
They smell so good. They smell really great.
I'll let you try it and tell me what you think.
That's really nice. So you were saying you have what kind of a nectar?
Oh, so I use agave nectar, which is, it's a, I guess, kind of a health supportive sweetener. It's low glycemic, so those who might be, you know, dealing with type 2 diabetes, it's one of the best sweeteners because it doesn't give you an insulin spike. And it's just very mild and really delicious, and it goes well with those biscuits.
You call for raw organic sugar and rice milk. Is this part of being an eco chef? I mean, do you have to use organic ingredients here?
Well, I always encourage people to use local, seasonal, sustainable ingredients for a number of reasons. You know, we can talk about the ecological benefits to the animals, but one of the reasons I encourage people to use seasonal ingredients and local ingredients most often is because of the flavor. I mean, when you use something that's harvested that day that comes from either your front or backyard garden or, you know, a farm that's 50 to 100 miles outside of the city, it's going to be so much more flavorful and delicious than something that's been shipped across the globe or shipped across the country and sitting in warehouses for weeks and then refrigerated. But I always encourage people to modify my recipes. You know, I'd like to think that my recipes aren't proprietary. My publisher might disagree. But I want people to feel free to make them their own. And if one wants to use whole milk instead of rice milk, by all means, do so. If one wanted to use white sugar instead of raw organic sugar, you know, go ahead. I'm just presenting the most health supportive recipes as possible and then inviting people to make them their own.
And, you know, these biscuits are really, the consistency is wonderful. Jack, did you, how was it cooking? I can imagine getting a biscuit just right might be hard.
It was actually really easy. And what I did for this, since I actually took all of the flour, the baking soda, the baking powder, and I mixed it all together last night and put it into a bowl. And I took all the wet ingredients and put it into another bowl, brought it here to NPR, and then just mixed it all together here and threw it in the oven. The only problem I had with it was finding some of the ingredients for it. And I'm glad you said we could substitute because that was my biggest question, like things like cocoa butter. I had never used it before. I'd never even heard of it before. And I went to the local grocery store and I couldn't find it. I had to go to a couple places in order to find it.
The recipe calls for chilled coconut butter. And it, you know, in the book I explained it. I should have put that on the recipe, Jack. But, you know, coconut butter is simply coconut oil that has, you know, just kind of like sat. And a good way to take coconut oil and make it coconut butter is to put it in the refrigerator so that it can harden. You know, most health food stores carry it. Increasingly, more conventional grocery stores are carrying it, but a lot of times you might have to go on a treasure hunt to find coconut oil. But there are more studies that show coconut oil is a heart-healthy fat, and they're encouraging, you know, the use of it in moderation, certainly.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More, and I'm Jennifer Ludden. Eco-chef Bryant Terry is here sharing his recipes for a vegan Thanksgiving. So, Bryant, I don't know about you, but in my household, a perpetual problem is that the dinner, though delicious, is never done when we plan for it to be done. So you got to keep your hungry guests happy. Can we talk about some vegan appies?
I like to have snacks always on hand for when people arrive early. For this Thanksgiving, I'm going to be making my double maple coated pecans. And, you know, growing up, pecans were always readily available because my paternal grandfather had a huge pecan tree in his front yard. And so I decided to take this childhood favorite and make a sweet, simple snack out of it. So for the double maple coated pecans, it's simply we're using maple sugar and maple syrup. Thus the double maple.
Double. But,
and, you know, a lot of times maple sugar might not be readily accessible. So I encourage people to substitute whatever's available. If you have some raw organic cane sugar, use that.
But is brown sugar okay?
Brown sugar could work, but yeah, tossing in a little extra virgin olive oil, then the sugar, then the maple syrup, and let them cool for about 15 minutes, and you got a tasty healthy snack.
And Jack has made it.
You want to try one?
Yes.
There you go.
That's nice.
Crunch.
Mm-hmm. Jack.
What do you think, Jack?
Oh, man. This was great. And this was easy. I think the nicest part about serving something that you want to just throw out there is that it's also like that cooking. And the biggest problem I had with it was not eating all of them before I got to work.
He's very nice to share. All right, Brian, we have one last item here. I take it this is something best had when the relatives have all gone, the kids are in bed, and you can finally put your feet up.
Yeah, this is the end of the night. This has been a crazy couple of days entertaining all these people, and I just want to indulge in the cinnamon applejack toddy. I'm a big fan of toddies and also a big fan of the 1970s sitcom Sanford and Son.
Uh-huh.
Fred Sanford, one of his favorite alcoholic beverages was Applejack.
Listen to me. Son, you want some Applejack? Make
no,
you sleep.
I don't want no Applejack.
You better put Applejack on the grocery list and get some mineral oil and Pluto water.
What do you need all that stuff for?
Well, Applejack makes me sleep. And other stuff make me get up.
I decided to just play with that and make this simple toddy, which is a shot of Applejack, which is an apple-based brandy. And one can use any brandy that is available.
I think, Jack, you've got to tell us what you've got here.
Well, I'm going to play bartender for a second. So I've got some cups of water that are hot with the cinnamon stick in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got some of the Applejack brandy. I'm just going to put a little shot in here.
You actually got the Applejack.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm impressed, Jack.
We've got a little bit of the juices we'll throw in here.
Tell us about this, Bryant.
Just a little teaspoon of apple juice, just enough to give it a little oomph, and then some lemon juice for a little acid, agave nectar or whatever sweetener you have on hand, and then garnish it with the Granny Smith apple just for, you know, some beautiful aesthetics. But what's most important is the brandy.
We've got here. Cheers, Jack.
Cheers, Jennifer.
Cheers with plastic cups. So, Brian, that's all the food we've got here, but tell us what else might be on your table this Thanksgiving.
Well, one of my favorite things to make for Thanksgiving dinner, especially when I'm visiting other people's houses for the evening, is my apple cranberry sauce. And growing up, I have to admit, we ate that disgusting canned cranberry sauce. And, you know, I think a lot of people actually have that. And the thing about making homemade cranberry sauce, it's so simple. I mean, most grocery stores actually carry cranberries around Thanksgiving with the expectation that some people will make them. I just encourage people to get some of those fresh cranberries, some apples, and you can use a little orange juice. And it's very simple. Boiling it, bringing it down to low for 10 minutes, and then letting it cool off, and you have some delicious homemade applesauce. I make this stuff all year round, in fact. But
who needs Thanksgiving? Brian Terry is a chef and the author of the book Vegan Soul Kitchen, Fresh, Healthy, and Creative African-American Cuisine. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
And Jack Zahora, NPR producer, thanks for your good cooking today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks, Jack.
And that's our program for today. I'm Jennifer Ludden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
The ongoing debate over climate change continues online in the latest internet video gone viral. Just a picture of a skyline until you see objects falling from the sky. As the shot gets closer, you see that those objects are actually polar bears, and you hear the steady roar of a jet engine growing louder and louder. As the video continues, you also hear the sound of those falling polar bears slamming into the sides of buildings, falling splat on the sidewalk, or crushing into the top of a parked car. Gruesome stuff. The screen then goes black, and a message appears. It reads, "An average European flight produces over 400 kilograms of greenhouse gases for every passenger. That's the weight of an adult polar bear." That video is produced by the British environmental group Plain Stupid. That's plain as in airplane. It's clearly meant to shock people, but are the claims accurate? Well, for more, we turn to Andrew Revkin. He covers the environment and climate issues for The New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
This ad is clearly shocking, but I'd like to do a little bit of fact-checking on the specific claims that are made. The claim that the average European flight produces more than 400 kilograms of greenhouse gases for every passenger. That claim true or false?
It's consistent with what I've seen for assessments of how much the burning of fuel per person per mile adds up to. If you look at the United States, it's over a ton of emissions to go from the east to the west coast. couple tons, obviously, to do round trip. So again, it's in the ballpark of what I understand.
And that adds up to the weight of an average polar bear?
Well, there are polar bears that are well over the half ton range, having been in the Arctic a few times and avoiding seeing them, which is what you want to do when you're in the field. But learning a lot about them through, from scientists. Yeah, that's right.
Plain Stupid, the group that produced the video, claims that aviation is the fastest rising cause of climate change. Is that correct?
Well, in a way, it could be a red herring. It is a fast rising source of emissions. The world is becoming knitted by aviation in ways that are just unbelievable. And the wealthier people are flying more and more, and even in developing countries. But it's still a very small portion of the overall pie of emissions globally. It's under a couple of percent, I'm quite sure.
Why do you think they chose polar bears falling from the sky?
Well, I think there's this ongoing effort in the environmental community to get people to make linkages that are tough. It's, when you're flying or driving or running your household, turning up the heat and doing all the things we do that produce emissions, most people aren't thinking about the future of the Arctic or sea level. And there's this eagerness to somehow concretize that connection for people. And I think that's pretty clear what they were trying to do here. Although they have a tough go because the Arctic is not exactly the wake-up call that some would hope. In other words, it's a faraway place. Most people will never be there. It's a place in the mind. So can you actually get people to change their energy habits or voting habits based on the fate of polar bears to begin with is unresolved?
Andrew Revkin, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Andrew Revkin writes for the New York Times, and he covers environment and climate issues.